The February 20th meeting of Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. And we have a number of people in the audience with us today, and I'd like to introduce the Congress of Minnesota Resorts who are with us today. So warm welcome. Thank you for joining us today, and we are going to be dealing with shoreline issues today and the shoreline regulations presentation, so hopefully you find it interesting. I myself do represent a number of resorts up in my district, which includes Becker County and all of Norman and Menominee counties and southern parts of Polk and Clearwater, so some of you may be from the Becker County area, I don't know. So, what we're going to do first of all is to hear testimony from Kent Lockesmo of the DNR, the Waters Division Director. Director Lockesmo, thank you for joining us today. And we are also going to be hearing from Henry Von Offelen and Paula West from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy and Minnesota Waters. And and maybe before we begin, we do have to approve of the minutes for both February 13th and 15th. Would somebody move, Representative McNamara?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to move the minutes. Do you want to do them one at a time, or do you want them to?
I think we probably should do them one at a time.
The 13th. I'll be glad to move the minutes for the 13th.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. Moves the minutes for February 13th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Representative McNamara?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd love to move the minutes for the meeting on February 15th.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. Moves the minutes for February 15th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. And again, thank you, Mr. Lockesmo, for joining us today. And if you would please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Kent Lockesmo. I'm the Director of the Division of Waters for Minnesota DNR. And in your packets, members, you'll find two fact sheets. The first is titled Protecting Our Rivers and Lakes, and this basically gives an outline of the shoreline management program and the evolution to where we are today. And I'll just real quickly go through that. Shoreline management in Minnesota, and you know, everybody here knows we're blessed with lots of lakes, and there was a study done in the early looking at the development in the 60s and 70s and determined that there was a need for specific regulation. So the legislature created the Shoreline Management Act in 1969. That led to the first set of shoreline management rules in 1970. And the rules provide minimum standards. Local units of government can be more restrictive if they desire. And counties then were required to add those standards to their specific zoning controls. That and the county's zoning controls are in Chapter 394. The shoreline district was defined, and shoreline district for lakes is 1,000 feet from the ordinary high water level. For rivers, it's 300 feet from the bank of the river. And the shoreline management rules provide identified the sizes of lakes that were regulated. For counties, it's 25 acres in size and larger, although a county, if they wish to, could regulate smaller bodies of water. And likewise, for cities, the size was 10 acres and larger. So those standards then were adopted through the early part of the 1970s by counties. In 1973, the Shoreline Management Act was amended to include municipalities, because there were situations where a lake was half in the county and half in a municipality. So there was some unfairness, I guess, in that process. So starting in 1973, we started dealing with municipalities. We developed a separate set of standards specifically dealing with municipal shoreland that was established in 1976. In 1983, there was a study done, Shoreline Update Project, looking at how things were going. It was determined after that study that there should be a new set of rules developed. And actually, there was a set of rules developed that was shopped out to the public. There was lots of concern and controversy. A an advisory committee was then developed to hear those concerns and to refine the rules. That happened in 1989. Then the second version of the shoreline rules was adopted. One of the things that happened in 1989, is instead of having separate county and municipal standards, they were combined into one set of standards that were applicable to both. So these now govern approximately 250 local units of government. Moving forward to the recent few years, in 2004, as part of the governor's Clean Water Initiative, there was a pilot project for the five counties in north central Minnesota, basically around Brainerd. And this now is in the second handout that you have in your packet. So in 2004, we assembled a group of stakeholders. Again, this is a 34-member advisory committee that we had for this process. We did a survey of issues and then worked on the issues that were most important to these 34 members. The alternative shoreline standards are not new rules. They were alternative standards. Local governments considered adopting them or not. And basically, as these standards were developed, we looked at what was working in some counties and tried to expand upon that and certainly made it available and informed the rest of the counties about the good things that were going on, because, as I said, counties can adopt something that's more restrictive than the minimum state standards. These standards include, and I know Henry Van Afflin is going to follow me, and he has a PowerPoint that will show this whole list on the screens. But we did look at the advanced changing the subdivision control so there's better promotion of conservation in subdivision of land, looking at multiple shoreline classifications on a single lake. So when you have a shallow protected bay that's far different than the lake, you don't have just one classification. And maybe I should back up and talk about the classifications. There are three classifications for lakes. General development is the least restrictive. Those are the lakes like a Lake Mille Lacs or a Gull Lake or in the Whitefish Chain, where there was already a lot of development when we started shoreline zoning. And the least restrictive is natural environment lakes. These are the smaller lakes with very little development. That's has the largest lot sizes and the largest setback. And between those two is a classification called recreational development. So there is that process. We went through and identified the lakes and gave them classifications and worked with the counties. There is a process to amend those classifications if they have justification for that. So these rules now look at more at the sensitive shoreline and how to address that differently. There's also improved planned unit development standards, including residential densities for all PUDs, increasing the setbacks, clustering, grouping dockings, so we just eliminate the impact on the lakes. One of the things that's here, and certainly that's one of the things many of the members or the people that are here for the resort industry, I'm sure are interested in the next bill, and we did look at how to deal with resorts differently than they are in the current rule. And there's a lot of discussion about how we keep resorts that want to continue functioning as resorts viable. And these standards do address that. And we think that's something that should be pursued. The standards also call for better management of stormwater runoff, larger lot sizes for brand new developments on general development lakes. And these standards were in the process. I think the third page in your handouts is a copy of a map that shows the state, and it's colored in green and yellow. My copy's in here someplace. Basically, the green counties have adopted some portions of these alternative standards. There aren't any counties that have adopted the standards in total. They've looked at the pieces that work for them that they feel are needed and I believe there's 8 counties that have adopted something already, and there's another 7 that are evaluating these standards to see what works for them. Shoreland management is something that we need to take an important and a close look at. We were petitioned by MCEA to take these voluntary standards and make them mandatory statewide. We declined and denied their petition, and I just understood on the way over here that they've now sued us to force that process, apparently, so, which is unfortunate because I think now we're going to have to spend time on that instead of spending time on what's really important to look at how we should move forward on updating these in a public open process. So with that, I will let Henry stand off and follow me, and we can answer questions now or at the end, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. I don't know. Yes, Representative Moe has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up, Mr. Lacus, Moe, to your last point there. Had you not been sued or petitioned, what would the DNR's plan be for furthering the alternative shoreland standards? I mean, there's some counties which aren't on your map. How do you envision those counties beginning to adopt some or all of these standards?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, what we're doing is actively marketing the alternative standards. We're discussing this with the counties. There's 4 training sessions in the end of March, first part of April, with zoning administrators. We're working with the counties and local governments. The Shoreland Management Program we develop a statewide standard, but these are administered by local units of government. So the state doesn't have any direct authority over those decisions. If a county or local government makes a decision that we don't like, our recourse is, like anyone else's recourse, to take them to district court. So what we're trying to do is work with the partners, our local government partners, and show them the value in adopting some of these standards. And the resource is not uniform across the state, so there are some differences. That's one of the main differences from 1989 rules, that the 1989 rules have from 1970, is that the 1970 were inflexible and it was a one-size-fits-all, and the 1989 rules have a provision, and each ordinance has a provision that allows for flexibility, and that if a local government can justify a modification of those minimum standards, there's a process for us to review that.
Representative Moe.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lackland, just a quick follow-up then. So then I heard you say that the only potential stick or the only tool that the DNR, the state, might use for enforcing any of these additional standards would be district court and not any future rulemaking process or anything like that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe. Oh, there's always a process to move forward with a new rule and a new process, and we would do that with an open process and starting from the front end with everybody understanding that they were going to be mandatory statewide rules, and that is an option that would be available, and we are evaluating what it would take to get there.
Any further questions for Mr. Lacusmo? Seeing none, Mr. Oppeland, thank you for joining us today. And if you could please state your name for the Van Oppeland, excuse me. If you could please state your name for the record.
Sure. My name is Henry Van Oppeland. I'm a natural resource scientist for Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I live in Detroit Lakes and work from there.
Okay.
And thank you all for being here. This is an issue that is, I think, a hot topic these days amongst folks in Lake Country. And in front of you have some handouts that goes over these slides that I'll be going over today. We did a similar presentation yesterday to the Senate, and we've shortened it quite a bit, and Paula West is not here today, so I will be doing the entire presentation. And really what you have in front of you is much of what we learned in the alternative standards rulemaking process. There were, as Kent mentioned, there were 34 people, a wide variety of stakeholders that met for, I think, 11 or 12 times over 11 months. Many long meetings discussing these things that are important to all of us. So it was great to be on that committee. There's also in the packet, and Paula would not like it if I didn't mention this, a DVD, Minnesota Lakes at Risk. Much of the information we're presenting here today in slideshow form is also on that DVD. It was put together between Minnesota Waters and Minnesota Public Television. So what I'm going to talk about really is giving you an overview of, you know, what we have for resources and the pressures, consequences, and the solutions. And I think I have to hit a button here. Yes. Okay. The pressures, consequences, and solutions, and I'll give you just a very quick overview this afternoon. As you may know, we have 208,000 miles of lake shoreline in Minnesota. That's more than states that have coastlines like California and Florida put together. 64,000 miles of natural rivers and streams. One licensed boat for every six Minnesotans. 4.8% of our surface area is water. We have almost 5,500 fishable lakes. And as we all know, if we look in our pockets, perhaps the Minnesota State Quarter features our wonderful water resources. Well, things are changing in Lake Country. It used to be the cabin up north. As demographics change, we're now seeing more development like this replacing those cabins. This is putting additional pressures on our water resources. This is a classic side-by-side picture that many of us see if we drive around Lake Country of an older cabin, probably built just after World War II time or something in that range. And here's a new house right next to it that was probably, and this one's just a few years old. Big changes in Lake Country. We also have planned unit developments. There's been a move towards doing higher density developments on lake shores. And the rules, which were revised in 89, allow for these. And I will point out a little bit later in an example some of where the current plan unit development rules fall short and that we're addressed in the alternative standards process. As we develop Lake Country, we also see a lot of things like grass down to the water's edge. And I'll be explaining a little bit more of the consequences of that. And lots of impervious surfaces on our waters. And if you watch this close, we are altering the shoreline substantially. And these have impacts. And the impacts are accumulating as all these pressures change. We're creating parking lots for our boats. And one of the issues that Kent mentioned that the ALT standards try and address quite well is that the shorelands that remain in Minnesota often are what we call marginal shorelands. They're also shorelands on shallow lakes. They're also shorelands on bays of big lakes. That the big lakes are developed. We have shorelands and bays that looks like this, which wasn't developed for the last 50 or 100 years because there are difficulties there. These sorts of properties are now getting to, you know, desirable because they're the last stuff left. And I need to also mention rivers because the shoreline rules apply to rivers. They are the last frontier of shoreline development, and areas around St. Cloud and other river areas, certainly shoreline rules and regulations on rivers are important. And we all need to realize, I think, that we're not making any more shoreline. Perhaps if you're down in Iowa where they build lakes on a regular basis, we could build some more shoreline. All right, so that's sort of very quickly an overview of some of the pressures. I'm going to talk about water quality consequences, fish and wildlife consequences, and a little bit on economics. This slide just shows on the left is undeveloped shoreland. The middle is moderately developed, and I'd say on the right is probably excessively developed, and maybe someone who has some background in aggregate industry or something. So, but we have runoff volume from these properties on this slide, phosphorus inputs, and sediment inputs. Background levels, we have basically natural levels, low levels of runoff, phosphorus, and sediment. When we get into the moderate types of development, still quite a natural shoreline area. Runoff and phosphorus inputs don't necessarily change very much, but we get substantially more sediment into our waters. When we step over into the more intensive development, we are increasing runoff volumes, increasing phosphorus inputs, and also dramatically increasing sediment inputs. And this can apply to a whole lake or just a bay of a lake. This one just shows why phosphorus is critical in freshwater systems. This was an experiment in Canada done quite a few years ago where they actually curtained a lake off. That's what that yellow line is in the middle. Put a curtain there, and for 8 years they added phosphorus each year, and it turned pea soup green. Very common reaction. Phosphorus is a limiting nutrient in freshwater systems. So with runoff, we get phosphorus. And this one, all I want to point out is this is the relationship between phosphorus. As you go from left to right, the phosphorus concentration gets higher. And from on the vertical axis is water clarity. The more phosphorus, the lower water clarity. And the important thing here is there seems to be a tipping point in lakes generally. We can't certainly say every lake, but somewhere in that 25 to 30 parts per billion phosphorus is when a lake will switch to being a much more turbid lake. And folks in Itasca County working for the DNR have taken and done some modeling of what their phosphorus levels may look like with as development increases on lakes. So they've taken the good science, put it in a model, and it's just interesting to note that right now we're in that 20 range, say, for this study, most of the lakes that were looked at, with more development and even more, and I'm not exactly sure what those numbers are, but I'm sure we could get them. We are going to be approaching, even in the Itasca area perhaps, that sort of getting into that phosphorus level, which could really start to cause problems for water clarity. We all know that lakes and rivers are important fish and wildlife habitat. There's also been some good research in Minnesota and elsewhere on the importance of and the impacts of shoreline development. Plain and simple, the study done in the Brainerd Lakes area, in developed shorelands, there's a 66% reduction of aquatic vegetation compared to undeveloped shorelands. We have fewer fish and less diverse mix of species on developed shorelands and undeveloped shorelands, or more natural shorelands, if you want to call it that. This is some information from the Alexandria area. They studied three different lakes, and they looked at where bass and crappie were nesting. The undeveloped part of the lake shore is in green. The developed part is in red, and the in-between stuff is in yellow. And on three lakes, this was very consistent. Undeveloped shoreline was the preferred habitat for both crappie and bass. In terms of wildlife, this is percent plant cover on undeveloped and green, and sort of a brown, to my eyes at least, developed. We've got, and this is of course no surprise, but some scientists went and actually measured this stuff. We lose tree canopy and we lose shrubs as shoreline is developed. Similarly, on undeveloped lakes, we have sort of more diverse, desirable species of birds, songbirds. On developed lakes, we have more what they call here uncommon birds, or for any birder, those are certainly less desirable types of birds. Community shifts of species in shoreline areas. Similarly with frogs, there's been huge declines in frogs as shoreline is developed. And in fact, some folks view frogs as sort of a canary in the coal mine and other amphibians. That brings us to, that's all the fish and wildlife, so the next piece is a little bit of economic development. We all know that our waters and clean waters are important for economic development in the state. Tourism is a $9.2 billion industry. Generates $1 billion in state and local taxes. Fishing alone is estimated to be about $1 billion. And shoreland property values are in the $250 billion range. economically speaking, there is a relationship between property value and water clarity. This was a study done a few years ago at Bemidji State. It also was a follow-up to similar to a study done in Maine, where water clarity is property values are directly related to water clarity. Another economic study that was done, this one was done in Wisconsin, where they took and changed shoreline regulations on some lakes from 100-foot minimum lot size to 300. I think they did a few other things. They had over 1,000 property sales during, I think, a five-year period in the 90s, and there were still substantial increases in shoreline values because of, with the additional protections. And that makes sense. It's sort of similar to the open space type work done in the metropolitan region, where open space in an area of development is valued, just as in this case it appears that the same is for shorelands. If we have good conservative shoreline regulations that protect the integrity of the water body, we will also perhaps have better economic value long term. So in summary, all the science says we have increased runoff. I didn't mention even recreational use. That increases as the parking lot for boats increases. We have reductions in water quality. We have alterations and fragmentation of habitats. And in the end, these changes will reduce long-term economic value. So that's sort of a summary of the science. And we go on to, you know, Kent described the system that we have of shoreland zoning in the state. The state sets minimum standards and local land use controls and zoning ordinances are the ultimate controls in the shoreland zone. Three classifications of lakes and lots of different issues. There's a bunch of challenges for local governments. The shoreland rules haven't been updated since 89, and what we see is from our perspective, current statewide rules are inadequate. Development pressure is happening fast. There's always, it seems, a struggle between short-term property tax gains versus long-term sustainable property values. And I know counties always are struggling for enforcement of shoreland rules. This one, and maybe some of you have seen this in other presentations, is what we're facing. Development, this will cycle through from the 1940s to 2030. And this is why the North Central Lakes Pilot Project was started, because that central region of Minnesota is the one that's really growing. But also notice out west, say in the Detroit Lakes area, the Alex area, the Fergus Falls area, things are also expanding and housing density is expected to increase. And this is from the state demographer, and again, why the five counties were chosen for a pilot project, that we're expecting to see substantial population increases on top of all the sorts of development changes that are happening out there. And I think, development is inevitable. Certainly what we can't deny that. And the rules that we have both statewide and at the local level are really how much, where, and how we do it. And I think we can be, given since 1989, we can be a lot smarter about how we do things. And that's the sort of stuff we discussed in the alternative standards process. And if you're interested in this, and I would really recommend you go to the DNR's website and look over the documents. They put a lot of time and effort, as did citizens, in putting these alt standards together. And there's also an assessment and rationale for the standards that lays out why all these changes are needed, covers much of the stuff I just talked about. It was a great process that DNR held in 2005. And I know there's a few other people that were on that committee. I'm sure that they would say the same thing. And as Kent said, he went over these quickly, I will do the same. The key components are some new and revised definitions. Very important part of it is narrowing up some definitions, and I'll give you an example later. Multiple shoreline classifications, going from not only just general development, recreational development, and natural environment lakes, but there's a new special protection lake class that's been added. We also have the ability to, say, protect a bay on a lake. If it's a general development lake, we could just designate that bay as special protection or natural environment. Shoreland access lots are dealt with. there's right now a common trend of getting one lot on a lake, buying 40 acres or more, back off the lake, and then funneling all the access through that one lot. That's been a big concern, and it's addressed in the shoreline rule, the ALT standards. Planned unit developments are addressed, as well as a new concept that some of you may have heard of, conservation design. Land subdivision parts are addressed. The resort section, currently resorts are underneath the planned unit development section of the rules. It pulls them out separately and treats them as they should be treated, as a different entity from planned unit developments. It also, the rules deal with stormwater issues. The science of stormwater management has changed substantially in 20 years. We have some of that in the new rules, and there's some more specific administration for state and local. Okay, now I'm just going to run through a couple examples, and I should be pretty much wrapped up. This is a current subdivision that would be okay underneath the current rules. You've got 20 lots. There's a wetland area, and in typical fashion, you just cookie cutter up this lot to get your 20 units, however you could, based on the rules. The ALT standard subdivision has a disincentive in it for standard subdivisions. And in the new ALT standards, you would have 10 lots would be allowed on that same piece of property if you wanted to do a conventional subdivision. If you wanted to choose to do a conservation subdivision, which are pretty explicitly put into these rules step by step, you could then go back to about 19 homes. Rather than having 9 docks, you'd have one centralized dock. You'd avoid the wetland area, and you'd have at least 50% of it would be open space or more. So this is sort of that the approach that the ALT standards took was, if you want to do conventional subdivisions, go ahead, but our lot sizes are a little bit bigger than they are now, which is trying to promote, and remember, most of the shoreline that we have left is this marginal stuff, and this does not apply to lots of record, that it was really promoting this design, which is trying to really avoid those sensitive areas that we have left and still allow for reasonable development. And I'll give you an example of this, of what's going on out there. This is Becker County. This is a development proposal. Ice Cracking Lake is a recreational development lake. Ice Tea Pond is a wetland. Tea Cracker Lake is 120 acres. And the other than A, B, and C, the rest of Tea Cracker is either Tamarack National Wildlife Refuge or Becker County tax forfeited land. And the developers came in and proposed the lots you see on Ice Cracking. That all went through and got approved. They came back and tried they proposed 11 lots on Tea Cracker. The County Environmental Review Committee said, no, we want you to do something different if you develop this at all. And they suggested doing some sort of conservation design or clustering, because this involves a road going between the two, Ice Tea Pond and Tea Cracker Lake. And this is just a picture of what that area is like. It's entirely wooded now. There's a road that was just put in for the ice cracking development, and everything in the foreground is Tamarack National Wildlife Refuge. So they want, you know, this is the sorts of development that folks are proposing. This is a 120-acre lake entirely fringed by wild rice. That's where development is occurring now and will continue to occur, because that's the only shoreline left that isn't developed in many areas. Certainly there's lakes that aren't developed. Another example, this is from the City of Detroit Lakes. Just to get your bearings, Detroit Lake is on the right, the Pelican River is on the north side of this, and then there's another, Muskrat Lake is on the left, and that's Highway 59. 58 acres was annexed by the city, just under the 60-acre minimum for hearings, of course. So, and this is what the proposed development was underneath current standards: 130 RV units on this piece, on this 42-acre piece of property. Underneath current standards of PUD, there are requirements for open space. I've highlighted in yellow the wetlands at this site, all along the river, and then a large one in the middle of, or near the middle of it. Those 130 units, underneath the current standards, they can call this 60% open space on this parcel. Because everything that isn't a road or isn't a camper, RV pad, or a parking lot is counted as open space. So the 20 feet between those pads that you see gets figured into the open space calculations. And this is what's happening, with the sort of the way the definitions are in the current rules. Now, I view this as those are clusters underneath the definition of cluster. Those red areas would be clusters. When you count the red cluster areas and the part of the wetland area, there's no way that we would have anywhere near 60% open space in this parcel, which they are also touting as we have, this environmentally friendly 60% open space development. In the new standards, there's a better definition of clustering and open space. So in the new standards, when you cluster something, the shaded areas here in around the dwelling units are part of the clusters. They do not get counted as open space. So we get a much better and clearer rules for local governments to follow also. This is just an example, again, in the Detroit Lakes area. Pelican Lake, you see Fish Lake on the bottom. It's a lake, and then there's a small bay. And this one has, there was a development proposed for this shallow bay on this general development lake with, I can't recall right now the density, but it was a very high density development being proposed. The developer is finally, and there's a newspaper article in the back of your packet from the Pelican, or the Fergus Falls Daily Journal, where they finally pulled back and dropped the development. So, because of environmental review issues, and the Lake Association wasn't happy with what had been proposed. And, that's just some of what's happening out there. This comes to where we are today. We have this great document, these alternative standards that have been put together by a wide group of people. And we're expecting a voluntary approach to getting these standards implemented. And, it's been over a year. And if you really look closely at that list, and I provided sort of a marked up version of the DNR's table, that there is a lot of, there's certainly some things that have been grabbed by counties, but there certainly haven't been very many. And if you really look at the list, there's also many, many counties that apparently haven't even started to consider these. So we're just not convinced that a voluntary approach to this is going to work. As Mr. Lacosmo said, we petitioned DNR. There is citizens can do that, or organizations. We would like to see DNR move towards statewide rulemaking using these standards as a basis. So, and that is our position. And we have we also think that if we can move towards statewide rulemaking, and really this is resetting the bar. We set the bar in 71. We reset it in 89. It seems like with all the science, all the knowledge that we have, we should be setting the bar again. And we're going to continue to try and work with DNR to come up with a move towards statewide rulemaking. And after rulemaking, we still have other things to deal with. There are, issues of how we fund our current shoreline management system, how it's administered, and how things are enforced. So with that, there's some other things in the packet. I had a survey to planning and zoning administrators. We have a list of supporters of our petition, including multiple statewide groups. That's on page 16. Some recent articles that demonstrate what's happening out there. And then there's also some testimony that was given yesterday by three Lakeshore property folks on some of the situations they've encountered. And I think Dead Lake, the last example, is a really good one. That one had two different lawsuits, one to the Supreme Court. Otter Tail County is still not considering seriously the changing their ordinances. So I'm not sure how many lawsuits they need. There's also in here a letter from John Sumption from Cass County, who's been one of the very, they've changed their ordinance 20 times since 1989. So they are, you know, they would like to see some new statewide standards going. So. Okay. So that's pretty much the end of mine. You know, the last thing I guess is we adopted the rulemaking process that we went through, the ALT standards development process. There was lots of discussion and lots of compromise. There's things in there that go along with other things. And it was really conceived as a package. So that's why we have asked DNR to move forward with it as a package. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Van Offelen. And I was wondering, Mr. Lockesmoe had talked about how in 1970 the first standards were really written statewide and that there was a problem with the rigidity because of how different areas of the state differed from each other. And I was just wondering as far as the alternative standards, this was really written for one particular geographic area, those five counties. Would those alternative, you were talking about using the alternative standards as a basis for statewide rules, would those standards fit in all areas of the state? Would there be differences like in the agricultural areas, for instance?
Mr. Chairman, I think what we have said since we filed our petition is we need to go to statewide rulemaking. We understand that needs to be a public process. For the most part, the issues that the ALT standards addressed cover things that are happening statewide. PUD issues are statewide. Shallow lake issues are very much statewide. Most of that list that I gave of what the ALT standards do are statewide issues. Agriculture, we decided not to. We did not address agriculture. Agricultural issues in shoreland rules are, I would say, about that many lines. It's a very small piece of the shoreland rules compared to all the other regulatory pieces in there. So, I think if we move to statewide rulemaking at some point in the future, that there would have to be agricultural interest there. Right now, there's basically a 50-foot buffer. That's the big thing on from the ordinary high water level of lakes. There's a 50-foot buffer. That's the big issue. Personally, I would just like to see if we could just enforce that one right now.
Thank you, Mr. Van Offelen. And Representative Moe, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Van Offelen, for your presentation. Very helpful, I think, informative. Just a question specific to, counties that I represent, Cass, Itasca, Beltrami, have been some of the leaders in selecting some of the standards, adopting them, but they haven't, none of the counties have adopted them completely, even though Cass County in particular has been pretty aggressive. On what basis have counties voluntarily adopted some of these standards and chosen to not adopt others?
Mr. Van Offelen.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, I'm not sure I'm the person to be asking that question. Mm-hmm. I think that would be best addressed at the county level. I think some of the responses to the questions that I sent out a survey to about 25 counties and got those back. I think they're picking some of the sections that they're going to be the easiest to get through their county boards. That would be my guess. On page 14 and 15, I have some responses to two questions. What types of shoreland issues are greatest threats and challenges in your county? But on page 15 is sort of maybe gives us a little more insight into that. Ordinance changes that the county is likely to consider in the next year. I know whether these changes are all related to the ALT standards. You might want to look over some of those. I like, the Planning and Zoning Administrator's response in number 3 was would like to suggest shoreland ordinance changes in 2007. Later on, I'll try to do this, but if the board says no, it's not my fault, there's not stronger protections, new board will be difficult. Similar sort of response in responded 4, it's unknown which changes our county board favors. It's the system has been the state sets the bar. Counties can then have the flexibility to work underneath that bar, or above the bar, if you will. And that's where we're at today. I think it takes time to get things through local governments many times also. even Hallie Larson from Lake Melissa, who testified yesterday, you know, while they were going through the review of the shoreline program, there were two different changes of county boards during that time. It makes it very difficult. I don't know if I really answered that question. But.
Representative Moe.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it's a difficult question for you to answer. Many of these things are beyond your control. Counties, when you began this process, though, specifically in the five-county area, you know, that most of which I represent, what was the understanding, though, as to how the counties or the stakeholders would move forward when you began this process? Was there... Mr. Lacus will address this a little bit, and I guess this would be an opportunity for you to respond.
Sure.
Mr. Van Offlin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe. Well, if you go back, and all the minutes from the Alt Standards meetings are online and available at DNR, these were always discussed as initially for the first 5 months of the process until the July minutes, these were discussed as alternate standards for the five-county area, and they were voluntary. And at one point, there was an effort perhaps to have actually in the DNR rule book or whatever you call it, or Minnesota rules, that there would be a chapter, Alt 6120. And in July of 2005, when we were about halfway through the process, that was clarified that these would simply become a voluntary document. And if you look through those minutes also, we understood the DNR had to go through and have these as voluntary rules because in order to get everybody at the table, it was good to have them as a voluntary set of rules. But the minutes also clearly show later in the year that several of us did say, yes, they're going to be voluntary. We understand what that means for now, but this is such a good document, we should move forward at some time in the future statewide. And after seeing those there for a year with really very little action by many or most of the counties, and DNR is in their phase three of the process, they are getting out there and doing public education and outreach, we just haven't seen a lot of movement. We're just, I don't know what other sort of statewide resources that we have that we're willing to, on a voluntary basis, offer protections.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I hope we're going to be here till about 8 o'clock. No. This is very interesting to me, and boy, it's hard to wear a couple of hats because I fit in a couple of your slides. I wrecked one of those beautiful little cabins and built one of the other ones next to it, and now I'd love to see some shoreline stuff change, and it can sure be conflicting. My question, Mr. Olaflin, would be Van Olaflin. Why would we want to do it statewide? I see a real need for us to adapt, and I see us pushing the DNR in the direction that we should manage the different resources within the state, whether it's game and fish or whether it's water or whatever, adapt locally to the conditions. I guess I really take if differently than you, I think we should be doing differently in the Crow Wing Cass County area than we do in Big Stone County or Dakota County where I live. And why would you not want to push the DNR just in that spot? And then I guess I would, at some point, Mr. Chair, also like to ask Mr. Lockersmo to come back down. I would like to ask some questions of him, too.
Sure. Mr. Van Offlin.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara. I think, you know, we've been here before. We've done this before. We set statewide rules. Lakes and streams are statewide public resources. In 89, we recognized that we needed to change those rules and update them statewide. We did so. We're now in, 2007. It seems like it's time to do that. This is about setting minimum standards for the future. And counties such as Crow Wing would certainly have the flexibility to set more progressive or standards and different standards as long as they met the minimum. And Crow Wing is a good example of what could happen if we leave this voluntary. Crow Wing County has, I believe, 12 municipalities with shoreland zoning ordinances in it, 10, 11, 12, somewhere in there. So now the county has adopted some of the plan unit development portions of the rules and the resort portions. I do not believe any of the municipalities there have. So you're going to have, even within one county right now, you have a patchwork of regulations that are not to what the alt standards say should be our minimum set of standards. But I think there's still plenty of flexibility underneath statewide standards for counties to do what they need to do, and municipalities.
Representative McNamara?
Well, and now I think I'm ready for Mr. Lockesmore. Maybe I think he'll be able to hear me as it comes down. My point would be, sir, I think we've clearly seen that the local units of government, specifically you can take one of the large lakes in the Crow Wing County area or wherever you want to go, if you want to do it in Representative Moe's district or Representative Fields district, the reality is they don't have it in them to do it. I think we have to go to the DNR. And I would ask Mr. Lackershmore, I think you've developed some great, I think you're calling them guidelines, contrary to what some of the members of the committee here think. I think they should be more than guidelines. I think that we should stand up and realize that things are, times are different now, and we need to address the local units of government. When you look at these lakes, we're killing them to death. And why would we not, Mr. Lackershmore, step up and say we need to do more than just ask the local units of government, who they can't give in. I mean, these are local folks. It's just too hard to say no to them.
Mr. Lockesmore.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara. There's probably two questions there. One is what were the ground rules that we used in developing the alternative standards? There was an understanding going into that they were voluntary standards and not rules. The change that we made in July that Mr. Van Auflin just mentioned, because we had talked about actually having a chapter in rules, but if they aren't mandatory, there was no need to go through the rulemaking, and rulemaking would have added 18 months to that process. We thought it was better to have them standards that would be available immediately instead of going through rulemaking to develop something that was voluntary and not be done with that process for 18 months. So what we're doing right now is looking at what would be needed to do a statewide mandatory rule, but start out then with a stakeholder group, with that being the understanding up front, not to have one set of guidelines and then change at the end of the process. And we will use all of the work that's been done. As Mr. Van Auflin said, there is lots of good science that went into developing the alternative standards, and we certainly are going to build on that. And we need to also include, like he mentioned, agricultural interests, if we're talking about expanding the buffer from 50 to 100 feet, there certainly are interests that will wish to weigh in on that.
Representative McNamara.
Last follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then let me ask this, Director Lockesmore. Would you say that if you see local units of government not implementing some of the suggestions that you have, and we continue to see folks mowing down to the edge of the water and putting phosphorus on the fertilizer right down to the water and just loving these lakes literally to death and seeing the weed rollers on all the docks and all the other things that I could go on and on about, cutting the weeds more than they're supposed to be, are you going to step up and do the rulemaking process like you said you have the ability to do, to where in the end we would come down with more stricter regulations from the DNR?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, many of the things that you just mentioned are not dealt with under the shoreland rules. The shoreland rules are from the ordinary high water level of the lake and landward, dealing with the setbacks and dimensional standards. The weed rollers, vegetation removal, those kinds of things are dealt with through aquatic nuisance control permits, through ecological services, through division of water permits if they're altering the bed of the lake. So there's a number of different entities and authorities that are involved in all of those aspects. Specifically, as far as the rules, we're looking at what will be needed to undertake a rulemaking process and develop a plan for that that we can present to the commissioner and others. We spent approximately $500,000 on these alternative standards, and to take that to the next step and develop a permanent rule on a statewide basis is going to be a major undertaking, and it will. There are going to be some financial resources that are needed.
Mr. Chair,
I
can't resist. Thank you. Mr. Director Lockridge, I will just tell you, $500,000 is a lot on Whitefish Chain, seven lots down from us. It's 130 feet of lakeshore that was just sold for $680,000. That's one lot in, I don't know how many tens of thousands on one lake in one county in our state. We have to put the resources to this to put some teeth behind it. I absolutely believe, because these resources are unbelievable. They're the livelihood for Representative Moe's district, for all these folks sitting back here, and they all have the temptation. Their 401k is converting Silver Sands Resort into some $3 million lot and develop it. And if we're lucky, it's one log home that some rich guy from Sioux Falls builds instead of a planned unit development with 19 townhouses, which, or whatever the proposal is. And I appreciate all you're doing, and I know you're getting pulled in a million directions, but I think in the future we better go in a direction that really saves the resource.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, yes, the values of lakeshore lots have increased exponentially, and I am aware of some of those, you know, similar sales of property. Those, it's something that the legislature needs to look at, and whether or not there's a way to generate a revenue stream to be able to more aggressively deal with shoreline management and with the administration and oversight of variances and local government. You know, none of those sales generate any money for the department or any other, or probably for the counties necessarily, to do better enforcement.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, just to reiterate from what he said, Mr. Loxmo, it's true that from the shoreline in, that's not what we're talking about with these alternative requirements, but the more people that you let develop up there on top, and the more subdivisions, the more houses, the more docks, the more weed control they're doing. And just for some of the members, after living up there 20 years, you would be amazed. We did a survey once. We took aerial photos of several lakes in successive years. It's just amazing how much shoreline and weeds disappear over the years, and habitat that disappears. And a lot of it has to do with the subdivisions and houses that are allowed. The closer they get in, then everybody gets down there. Once they get the dock in, then they want a beach. They want to take out weeds. And then you can want their 15-foot channel to take their boat out, and then they want their kids to be able to fish from the dock. And more weeds go out, and more development. And the closer the houses get together along there, even though it's from the shoreline back, that has an effect, too, on the habitat in the lake. I mean, the runoff and the destruction of the vegetation. And so it's really a mess. And I know nobody likes to take away local government control, and we all preach that, even though this next bill does some of that. But I don't think that we should be timid here, because it just isn't working. You go up there, and you go up there from year to year to year, and more is disappearing. And the lakes are really getting ugly. We used to go along and look at mom and pop cabins and resorts. Now you're staring into somebody's living room with huge trapezoid windows and chandeliers. And unless we do something about it and make it mandatory, I think, you know, we're going to change the whole reflection on the North Country. So.
And there are three more people who have questions, but I just want to remind people that we do have a bill coming up, and there are some people who have traveled down here a great distance to testify on that as well. So if we could limit it to those three questions, that would be great. And Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for Mr. Van Oppelen, I just have a question about your letterhead shows MCEA and Minnesota Waters. And so I'm assuming that you've worked with them and they agree with this document and your proposals. So my question then would be, Minnesota Waters is, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, a joining of Minnesota Lakes Association and the Minnesota Rivers Council. So they are really lakeshore and river property owners, which in my mind, would be the hardcore people. I mean, they would want as many rights as they could have. So I'm just kind of wondering how that melds together, and are they joining with you in the lawsuit?
Mr. Van Offlin.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Scalzi. Yes, we have worked with Minnesota Waters. You know, both of us, Paula West, who would have been here today but couldn't make it, and I were on the alternative standards rulemaking process. And yes, they are. They when we sent our petition in to go through rulemaking, they sent a letter of a strong letter of support 10 days later. I could not answer your second question, which was whether or not they'll support the lawsuit regarding the rejection of the petition. And I think perhaps perhaps that needs to be cleared up a little bit. We did petition, and I do have some slides of this, for rulemaking under Minnesota's Administrative Procedure Act, which you see there. And in some of the petition includes this directive to the DNR in the interest of public health, safety, and welfare to provide guidance, et cetera, just as we've been saying, to be the leader in protecting the resources statewide. And any agency or person may petition an agency for rules. And we did say in our petition that we need to move the ALT standards and make them mandatory, because that is legally our understanding of what we need to do in this petition process. And we want to go through whatever process is needed in order to get an outcome which is better rules statewide for our water resources.
Representative Dill.
My question was answered.
Representative Lagunias.
Thank you. Ms. Luxmo, you talked about the cost of doing a rulemaking, and what I heard from Representative McNamara and Representative Cornish was really the cost of not. And when I think about the cost to DNR, to taxpayers of not, it's having to supply chemicals for folks to get rid of their weeds because their lakes aren't healthy anymore, and it's having to stock the waters because there's not breeding ground anymore. So there's a cost to us, and I think it's pretty severe, of not moving forward rather rapidly. And I couldn't explain all the costs, but I think Representative McNamara and Representative Cornish did a good job of that.
So any other questions at all? Seeing none, thank you very much, both of you, for your testimony here today. And we are going to be dealing with a bill that deals with part of the alternative standards. Representative Moe, can you come forward, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I also want to thank all the resorters coming down. There's some of my constituents are here, actually, and it's good to see you. That Camouche Resort is not too far from my house, and he's driven down even further than me to get here, so thanks for coming. Just a little background, and then we have some testifiers here. As was presented, we have some challenges with shoreland in Minnesota, in particular, with the development of that shoreland. Resorts, small resorts, mom and pop resorts in particular, have been the stewards of this property for many years, generations, in fact, some of them. And we saw from the pictures that many of you saw here, the cabins, or that many mom and pop resorts, small resorts, are a series of cabins. The footprint of those cabins as compared to some of the large homes that are now in my neighborhood and some of your neighborhoods too, the direct impact is significantly greater. Not to mention, many, as was also stated, I think Representative Cornish said it, maybe Representative McNamara, the challenge to not sell or to maintain resorts for many of the resort owners here. You know, there's such an incentive for them to sell the properties, one, and two, to try to maintain a business. We want to do everything we can for them to keep the businesses in northern Minnesota as resorts, one, and two, to protect the habitat that they have been stewards of for so many years. So what this bill will do, Mr. Chairman, is take a portion of the voluntary standards that directly affect resorts and put them to statute. In particular, cabins, if they need to be updated for a variety of reasons, or if they're burned down or destroyed, would allow resort owners to rebuild them at that current location additional requirements, and if they needed to expand them for zoning or other reasons, that would have to be done away from the lake as opposed to toward it or laterally. I think it's a good piece of legislation, a good start for us. There are a few challenges that and interested parties will come up and testify that we've worked with, and we've agreed to work with those interested parties between here and the next committee. And actually, I would like to, I don't know if we've moved this bill or not, but I would like to actually move this bill to go to local government, would be the next stop, and then followed by probably bringing it to Natural Resource, Environment Natural Resource Finance. Representative McGinney has said that she'd be interested in this bill as well, so that would be the third stop. So, what do you want to do?
Representative Moe moves House File 849 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is before us.
With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to bring up Joel Carlson of the Congress of Minnesota Resorts. He'll be up first. And if we're all going to come down at the same time, I'll just introduce everybody. Yeah, great. Dana Pitt from Bailey's Resort, Dan Berg from Lakecrest Resort, and then after that we'll have Terry Neff from the Minnesota Association of County and Planning Zoning Administrators. He'll come up maybe afterwards. We'll make room for you. Thanks.
Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, just before we get into this, I just wanted to make clear that is this bill actually part of the voluntary standards? I haven't seen anything here that actually lists what the voluntary standards are, and I want to make sure that I'm on the same page.
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members, and Representative Gardner. I hope to be able to answer your question shortly. Mr. Chairman, my name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here today on behalf of the Congress of Minnesota Resorts. It's a group of small, family-owned resort businesses in Minnesota, and we're here today to talk to you a little bit about House File 849 and some of the challenges that they face. Minnesota once enjoyed over 3,000 family-owned resorts. We're down to about 900, and we lose 5 or 6 a month to development, to increasing land values and other pressures. And so we know that we have a decline, but we need to know what's at stake here. Minnesota resorts provide access to your constituents and Minnesotans to our great outdoor resources. That is how people enjoy, many people enjoy Minnesota resources. It is part of our heritage. It's a fabric of our Minnesota way of life. And we think it's a heritage that we hope this committee would like to preserve. TMR comes to the Capitol with issues that the legislature can deal with that help them remain viable businesses. We're not here to ask you to make the sun shine or the fish bite. We're here to ask you to address real issues that we have relative to the operation of staying in the resorting business. And one of those issues is and has been shoreline management. And House File 849 is a portion of the alternative standards that were developed, and we had two CMR members who served on that committee that developed those standards. And I'd like to just briefly go through the bill with you and then have Dana Pitt, who was on that alternative standard, talk a little bit about that process and why we're here today. Mr. Chairman and members, Section 1 of the bill addresses the applicability, and let's just get that right out in the open. This would apply statewide, and it would preempt local zoning as it relates to the three issues contained in the balance of the bill. And I know that's hard to do, but the reason that it preempts local zoning is because we want to preempt local zoning. We need to have these tools to remain viable. One thing that is unique in this bill is Subdivision 2. It provides for the first time a uniform definition of what a resort is. And this is part of the alternative standards. Ripson Gardner, I have them with me if anybody wants to look at them. But that definition of what a resort is, how many units, that they provide recreational opportunities, those things would provide a uniform definition for resorts, and we think that's important. If a resort is in operation and they have need to maintain or replace one of their structures, Subdivision 3 of the bill allows them that right to do that. This is consistent with other Minnesota law. We currently allow nonconforming uses to be maintained and to be rebuilt in Chapter 462 and in Chapter 389. So that part of the bill is not that big of a leap. We already have some of that ability right now. Subdivision 4 of the bill addresses a problem that resorts have with new regulations that have come into place since the time they were originally built. For example, the Department of Health has a 60 square foot per person requirement for a bedroom, so a two-person bedroom is 120 square feet. You might have a resort that needs to be rebuilt or maintained that has a 100 square foot bedroom. This section, Subdivision 4, would allow a resort to minimally expand, not lakeward, but backward, to meet the code requirements that may be in place. And they could be Department of Health regulations, ADA regulations, or other code requirements. And that's an important provision for resorts. The final provision of the bill, Mr. Chairman and members, deals with change of ownership. As you see lakeshore values increase rapidly, resorts are looking at alternative forms of ownership to remain viable and to be able to keep that resort in operation and available for use to the public. What Subdivision 5 says is that if you have a change of ownership of a resort, just the fact that that changes ownership, that does not constitute a change of use. And what's happening to resorts is that if they change ownership, some zoning authorities are saying that that's a change of use, and therefore you lose the current density that you have. We need to make certain that that alternative ownership does not change the use of the property so long as it continues to operate as a resort. Mr. Chairman and members, those are the provisions of the bill. Happy to talk about the alternative standards and the blue sheet that the DNR passed around to the members contains the issues that are in this bill. The bullet points on the back page begin to address the issues that are in the bill about maintenance, increasing building footprint. It doesn't on this page deal with the change of ownership issue, but that's where it comes from, Mr. Chairman, and we're here to ask for your help. We're happy to work with affected local units of government as we move this bill forward to try and make sure that we have satisfied as many concerns as we can that they have, but we need some help to make sure we can rebuild and maintain these facilities. Thank you for your time and attention.
You, Representative Cornish has a question.
Actually, it was a question of Representative Dill. Representative Dill, this is kind of like the bill you brought back for our friend up on the lake, wasn't it, with that boathouse? And at first, though, I was kind of worried about this, but now it looks like, in layman's terms, if you're not really want to expand, I mean, the only time you're really expanding is if you have to because of code, if you rebuild something. Otherwise, you just want to have the ability to replace something that's damaged or upgraded, but not as far as being up taller, closer to the beach, or making any gain financially, but just replacement, something similar to yours, right, Representative Dill?
Representative Dill.
Well, that boathouse bill was one fine bill, so this must be a good bill, too.
Yeah.
Right, Director Augustmo?
No.
What? Ms. Chair Eakin, I had Mr. Carlson, just one question. I think I understand it. On line 21, and 22. It talks about resorts offering for more than 30 days in a calendar year. Is the key word there, I guess I'd ask Mr. Helen, residential? Does that mean that a person is taking up residence? Because resorts commonly, at least in my area, rent to a family for a whole summer, one cabin. Now, they don't take up residence in terms of a residence, a legal place of residence. Their residence is probably in Minnetonka or somewhere. But they rent a cabin at a resort, for example, let's pick Nelson's, for an entire summer. Would that provision, I guess someone can answer that. Do you understand where I'm going with the question?
I do, Mr. Chairman and members. Representative Gill, the issue that addresses on 121 to 123 is we want to make certain that as we're working with local units of government, that as you have alternative ownership, that you simply just don't condoize the resort and one family uses it the entire year. We want to have those units in the rental pool so that there's access to the resource by the public. You could still easily have a rental that lasts for an entire season. Some of the provisions of this bill may not apply to those units. What we're trying to get at and preserve is the ability of the resort to keep those units in the rental pool. And that's not to do damage to somebody that has seasonal rentals, but that's what this is trying to get at in relationship to alternative ownership.
Representative Dunn?
Mr. Helen, did that answer my question?
Sorry. I think the key is that it's not your legal residence.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay, I'm satisfied with that. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to first look on lines 17, 18, 19, where it's talking about trying to describe what this property actually is, and it says that it's on line 18, it says, and having for rent three or more cabins, rooms, campsites, or enclosures. Three or more cabins, I understand. Three or more rooms seems to me like anybody with a house that wanted to rent out a couple of rooms could all of a sudden start to call themselves a resort, and then maybe get them underneath the umbrella of this provision of legislation, especially three campsites and enclosures, because some parts of the state, I would suspect, do not regulate campsites on a piece of property. So I'm wondering what your response is to that, so that we are actually targeting an actual resort. I see on the back, it also talks on line 2.3, it talks about by a licensee, but I don't know where we find the definition of licensee. I don't have the full statute here with me. So could you maybe address those questions?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Osmond, a licensee, as it is used in this context, is a resort that holds a license from the Department of Health. As to the room issue, you may have a lodge unit that has more than one room. I'm thinking of Wigwam Bay. It's a resort, and there are individual rooms or units in the, that are available for rental, residential rental purposes in that. So that's what that is intended to address. If it needs to be more clear, happy to do that. Do want you to know that the definition of resort that is in this bill is identical to what was in the alternative standards that was agreed upon and worked out through that process. So we didn't alter that at all. Mr. Pitt from Bailey's Resort was on that committee, and he can maybe address that definition more clearly. But it is identical to what was in what's in the alternative standards.
Representative Osmond.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Carlson, the concern I have is that when we have volunteer standards, that's different than putting something in the statute. And I'm concerned that if we have a resort, we're saying if you have rent out three campsites, that there is a, now all of a sudden, and I don't know that because you rent out three campsites that you even have a license from the Department of Health. And there's nothing here that says that it has to be both. Nothing says here that you're mandated to have a license. So I'm concerned that it may be too loose, that you're putting out a huge umbrella that somebody that may want to start to replace structures or whatever that normally would not be allowed to underneath some circumstances could use this legislation to get themselves covered. I don't know if that's possible, but I'm concerned that unintended consequences from statutes can be a huge issue further on down the road. So I think that they need to be addressed.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Osman, happy to look at that. You know, just as some comfort language, we are talking about facilities that are maintained, advertised, or held out to the public to be a place where sleeping accommodations are furnished to the public. And that the establishments must be primarily service-oriented for transient lodging of guests. I mean, those are some additional qualifiers to the rooms and campsites, but we're happy to look at that and make that as tight as possible so we're not opening the door. I would also say, Representative Osmond, that if you look online, 1.10, this deals with existing resorts. And council can probably advise us. I know that's just in the head note, and we're happy to put that in the text. But that's our intention here, is to deal with the existing population of resorts that are out there.
Mr. Chair. Representative Osmond.
Thank you. And Mr. Carlson, I appreciate that, and I understand what you're trying to accomplish. Just when we're passing statute that's going to override local control, whatever they have out there in the form of local control, we need to make sure that we're actually targeting that specific issue and not allow it for, that they've got control on how people are utilizing their properties to properly protect shorelines, and they may have rules saying you can't redevelop structures, and all of a sudden somebody puts up a sign on the edge of the road and says, well, I'll rent out 3 campsites, and therefore now I get to replace a structure that normally they would not be allowed to do. And I think that the way the language is right now, it has me nervous along that line, but I do not have the peace to be able to help us out. All I can do, I can raise problems, Mr. Chair. I just can't solve them.
Well, maybe Representative Moe can help us.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Osmond. A good point in review. I share your concern. My inclination would be to strike a portion of that language, but I would like to have the opportunity to actually look at implications of doing that and offering an alternative language within that essentially just specifies resorts without allowing people to have the opportunity to subdivide their yard in campsites or, you know, have structures, their doghouse, shed, or something else that would apply. I mean, that's not the intention. So with your understanding, my intention is to propose additional language that will come to local government if that will satisfy you. Thank you.
Representative Osmond. Okay. Representative Arginius.
Thank you. Perhaps the additional language that would work for Representative Osmond, and I share his concern, would be on lines 1.13 and have it in existence for more than a certain period of time, not just existing, because it could burn down and do as Representative Osmond said, but if it had been in existence for more than a year, 2 years, whatever, I think it would be much more difficult to get around.
Representative Moe.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Genius. Mr. Lacus Moe pointed out to me that, as Representative Genius stated, for the purposes of this section, resorts means an existing shoreland commercial establishment. So we might want to put in for how long it's existing, and that might answer this question. So I don't know if anybody has any suggestions, but I think that's something we should do. Would you say a year, or are you?
I would ask Representative Osmond what he would suggest for there for time, but. An existing means a commercial shoreline established that has been in existence for at least, and that includes. is the way you could word it.
Representative Osmond, any thoughts on that?
Representative Mr. Chair and Representative Moe, I'm very comfortable with you taking it to local government and actually picking out the language. It's local government that's going to be impacted by that language more than it is the environment.
Okay.
And that I suspect that as long as it's raised to your attention, that's what was my concern.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, we'll have an author's amendment in local government that will reflect that change. We might just adjust it accordingly to make sure that it holds water. Thank you.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, here's the scenario I'm going to paint. One of the people here have a resort, and they've got one cabin. It qualifies as two bedrooms. They're 8x10 each of them. They have one, it's called a bathroom because it's got a toilet in it, and it's got a 24-inch range and a mini refrigerator, and it needs to be fixed up. So they're going to build a two-bedroom cabin with a bathroom in it and a kitchen, and the next year they subdivide it and sell it as a cabin for $680,000. What would stop that from happening under this bill?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative McNamara, that very issue was put to me by Mr. Locksmith from the DNR. It's our belief that on line 2.4 that conformity applies to the establishment continues to operate as a resort. Now, I didn't have a good answer for Mr. Lockesmo about how long that unit needs to stay in existence to get at the very question that you're asking. And I think it's a valid question for us to have an answer for. No one put it to me before Mr. Lockesmo, and I think that's a valid question. Our intention here is to allow resorts to maintain and rebuild so that they can continue to operate, not so that they can condominiumize or build a big structure and then sell off for private development. That's not what we're trying to preserve. And if we need language to make that clear, we're happy to have that.
Mr. Chair, I would just really ask for follow-up along the lines of Representative Osmond. I picture the small resort with six cabins identified like I just talked about. They're a viable business today, as all these folks are, and the temptation to turn them into six cabins, like I described, and sell each one of them for $680,000 adds up to $4 million, and it's a nice 401k for the rest of them and their kids, probably, and they go to BSU or to Lake Vermilion or wherever they would want to go to, and they'd be covered.
Are you picking on my money?
No. I just want to make sure that if it's going to local government, because we should be very cognizant. The way I look at it, that can all happen here, and that's not something we should be doing.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Carlson?
President McNamara, I want to be clear that we're not asking to be exempt from any local zoning requirements as it relates to conversion of property to a different use. The scenario that you've described, unless they were able to meet the zoning authority's density requirements for each of those individual units, what you've described, we believe, would be a conversion of that property to another use. And if they're going to meet the density for that, they're going to lose those units. I don't think that's, I hope that's not a scenario that would happen, and to the extent we need language to prevent it, we're happy to have it.
Mr. Chair, I know we're late and running over, but this is preempting setbacks and stuff. This is preempting. They can replace it right on the shore. You can't do that today. This is allowing them to do that. This is allowing them to replace an 8x10 bedroom. It doesn't say. I've seen bedrooms that are 24x28, great rooms, two stories. None of that's identified, but we're telling them they have to do it. And I'm just saying that it's tough to pick on them when they're all sitting right behind me, but I want to be careful here. They want to restore their cabins and keep them be cabins. That's one thing. As Representative Osmond said, we put something in statute here and go telling the township Jenkins Township, sorry, you got to do it because McNamara and the legislature passed it, and it's a good deal now.
Representative Moe.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to follow up for a second, and then we have a couple other testifiers that have traveled the distance to be here, so it would be great if we had the opportunity to testify. Representative McNamara, you know, I share your concern, and I do not want that to happen. That's a large part of the intention here. In practicality, however, if some improvements are made to those cabins, either because they're acquired or there was damage and they repaired them, you know, if somebody's going to buy that property, they're going to tear those things down. You know, they're going to tear those cabins down and rebuild it a much larger home, which is ultimately what we'll want to prevent. So, again, thanks for the comment, and we'll definitely work on that. Michael? Right, and that's not permitted under this. Correct. If we could have the other testifiers here.
Sure.
Yeah.
Welcome, and if you could state your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Dana Pitt. I own Bailey's Resort on Leech Lake near Walker. I was involved in the DNR alternate standard rule committee. I attended every meeting with many different interest groups. There's a lot of give and take on the part of everybody there. To come up with a set of rules that not only protects the lakes but also helps resorts to survive. The rules as a whole are beneficial to most resorts. The problem is if they are implemented by counties or local units of government and picked apart at all, even by one word, they can completely change the meaning of the regulations as it pertains to resorts. If they're made any stricter, they can easily put us out of business. The environment we've got right now is a patchwork of shoreland zoning regulations for resorts. Some are good, some are bad, depending on where you're located. What this bill does is it makes some basic uniform rules for all resorts statewide. It takes the emotion out of decisions at a local level. For instance, maybe a local lake association putting pressure on a township or something to, maybe put a resort out of business that they don't happen to like on their lake. We felt that it would be hard to pass the entire shoreland standard as it was written. Just because of the variations around the state, not every lake, not every situation is created equal. However, this bill, we pulled out the key points that we felt every resort in the state needed to stay viable and stay alive. They were pulled directly from the DNR standards, and they would help resorts survive. And like Mr. Carlson said, it doesn't exempt us from addressing any other water quality issues. It just gives us some options to sell and to stay as a resort. It reduced the risk to a new owner coming in, knowing that he's able to rebuild cabins if something should happen to him. Right now, without that provision, it's hard to sell a resort that's worth what it is as far as property values go. If they're going to pay that kind of money for your property, they need to be assured that tomorrow, if that cabin burns, they can be able to rebuild and still be able to make it. Most of us, if we lose one cabin, we're going to lose the resort. We can't stay in business. We run that tight. And we need your support to get these basic provisions passed. There may be some changes and tweaking to the regulations to make them a little clearer, but we do need to get these provisions passed to help us thrive as important businesses in our communities and just to provide lakeshore access to the general public. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And one more person, if you could identify yourself for the tape, please.
My name is Dan. Dan Berg from Lake Crest Resort in Detroit Lakes, and I too certainly support effort for all resorts to stay in business. I think we've all heard about property values and lakeshore development, and all those issues directly affect what we do in our business and how we survive. And one way that we can survive as an industry is to be able to upgrade the cabins, replace them when they get damaged, and if we're not able to do that, that's just devastating. We have to have the ability to make the property, the resort property, worth more as a resort than it is as a developed piece of property. I mean, we can't stop lakeshore development. We can't stop property values from going up. But I think what we can do as a state is to look at different programs, incentives to help resorts stay resorts. And this is, one small piece of that. That pie. There's many other initiatives out there, and and talked about, but being able to replace a cabin that gets damaged is critical. To speak to the point the member made earlier about conversions, I know in Becker County, when a resort conversion takes place, there's a whole different set of rules that apply, and you're no longer a resort, so you don't fall within those density requirements. And when that resort is sold as not a resort, those density requirements have to come into play. And so if we're able to expand a cabin larger or replace a damaged cabin, at the time of conversion, those rules are kind of out. I mean, in Becker County, you have to play by the conversion rules and not by the resort rules, which are different. So it is addressed. But thank you for your support, and we'll go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. And any other testifiers?
I know for sure there's one carrying up, and we'll make some room here. Thanks.
And Representative Hansen has a question.
I could maybe ask it, Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Carlson, yeah.
And Representative Mo, Mr. Chair, I've been struggling here looking at, we're in the Environment Committee, and most of the questions that have been raised have been about local government. And I know that Representative Mo is a big supporter of local control, and you know, in his discussion about the compelling need that this commercial use would be environmentally better in the long run, and that justifies the preemption. I'm wondering if, in this committee, if there's a need to say that the establishment that continues to operate the resort would have a shoreline management plan if they're continuing to operate, so that they are doing some protection of the environment in order to receive this exemption or this preemption. And so I'd like Mr. Carlson or any of the resort owners just to see if that is something that could be added here in this committee as a requirement if we're going to allow the preemption, that the resort would at least have a shoreline management plan to protect the resource in order to receive the preemptive ability.
Mr. Carlson, or
Mr. Chairman and members and Representative Manson, this isn't the most controversial bill I've ever worked on, but it may get there soon. the way the alternative standards are written, those shoreline management plans would apply to resort units with 20 or more units. To the extent you require a shoreline management plan for a small resort that maybe has 100 feet, we don't know that that's viable for the expense or time. But to the extent that we're talking about bigger units that are doing more work, I think that that's something that the resort community is not adverse to accepting, whether it's here or at some point down the road. That's in the alternative standards. I want the committee to know that that the Congress of Minnesota Resorts supports the alternative standards, not just these provisions, but we've supported all of it. We just know we can't pass all of it because the amount of opposition we engender grows significantly. We think we can accomplish these, and we're certainly willing to look at that.
Representative Hansen, Representative Moe.
Yeah, Representative Hansen, thank you for your question. You know, there's a strategy as we go forward with this legislation, and you would know what it is. You know, this will come before you again, and there are portions of this alternate shoreline ordinances that would be more environmentally beneficial that we can entertain amendments to this bill on, you know, and I would be willing to work with you on that, on an amendment to take out more additional parts of this alternate shoreline ordinances and bring that amendment to Environment and Natural Resource Finance.
Representative Osmond, did you have a question? Or?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do have Mr. Carlson. As you were, I was hung up on the first page when you were explaining the second page, and and understand Subdivision 3 with maintenance and replacement, but could you re-explain as to why Subdivision 4 is in there with regard to expansion?
Mr. Chairman and members, Representative Osmond,
Subdivision 4 deals with the situation where you have a cabin in the shore impact zone that maybe needs to be replaced. To get a permit for it to be replaced, you need to meet what I'll use the Department of Health bedroom standard as an example. I've got a one-bedroom cabin that's in my one of my six in the resort, and I've got a 100-square-foot bedroom. Today, it's fine. But if I go to get a permit to rebuild that, I need to meet the Department of Health requirements of having 120 square feet for a two-person bedroom. What that says is that, what that language in Subdivision 4 says, is that they would be allowed to minimally expand that footprint backward to meet that code requirement, and only to meet that code requirement, so that you can rebuild a structure that is in compliance with existing standards, not what was maybe in existence in 1955. That's what that language is in trying to accomplish.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Osmond
Carlson, again, as I'm reading this and recognizing that we're exempting local ordinances in this process, essentially it says that you cannot have architectural elements such as more bedrooms. But if I, make the bedroom a nice big one, like Representative McNamara was talking about, it really, this kind of says as long as you don't get any closer to the shoreline, you can do just about anything you want, as long as you don't increase the number of rooms.
Mr. Chairman and members,
Mr. Carlson,
Representative Osmond, we read that slightly differently.
Okay, please help me.
We believe that the definition on 2.13 to minimally meet that standard means you're only allowed that incremental difference between if you have the 100 square feet and you need to go to 120 square feet. That's it. That was thoroughly discussed in the alternative standards, and that's all we're talking about, is to minimally expand only to meet a code. For example, on impervious surface, if you maybe have to install a ramp for handicap accessibility, but you're not in that impervious surface density requirement, this would allow you to do that to meet that ADA compliance, and that's all, nothing
all right.
more.
Thank you. That's helpful. Thank you.
Representative Moe?
I'm not sure if I want to add to this, Mr. Chairman. Just in practice, Representative, Joe's shaking his head. Okay. I'll hold that thought for the next
Representative Dale.
Thank you. I want to go back to Representative Hansen on the shoreline set. I'm not positive, and I'm not convinced one way or the other, that I'd err to the conservative that resorts of this magnitude that are covered under this bill would have the expertise, the knowledge to implement, to maintain, and financial wherewithal to maintain shoreline management plans, understand them, and implement them. I'm cautious when we get down to these smaller resorts that tend to be the ones that teeter and disappear more rapidly. Maybe that's not true either, but it seems that the smaller ones in our area are leaving and the bigger ones are still able to stay there. And isn't there some magic number on the shoreline management plan with regard to a resort, Mr. Carlson? You have to have a plan if you're over a certain size and number of units or something like that. Did you say that already?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, there's 20 units is what is currently.
Okay.
So, yes. And the testifier, next testifier is Terry Neff. Is that correct? Mr. Neff, if you could.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Terry Neff. I'm the Aiken County Environmental Services Director. I also sat on the alternative standards as one of the local governing units, along with a couple of my county board members as well. First thing I'd like to say is the section that pertains to resorts and alternative standards, I believe it's the only piece of the alternative standards that all 34 of us agreed on unanimously. I don't think there's anybody on that committee that opposed the alternative standards. Herein lies the problem with the proposed bill before you. It has no provisions in it whatsoever, regardless of the ability to move a structure back to bring it into compliance. And it's you know, Chapter 394, which is the enabling legislations for local units of government, gives us the right to do planning and zoning. It has a section there regarding nonconformities. This is totally against it. Nonconformities will be gradually brought into compliance. There's no provision in this bill to allow for that. I guess variances don't help too much, especially when you're over density, but there is a process in place that they want to replace these structures. That would be through the variance. It doesn't help with density, though. You have to take that into consideration. I don't want to be portrayed as against the resorts. This is one area where our county's looking at adopting in the alternative standards is the resort section. That's one of about three different areas we're looking at upgrading our ordinances with. We want to see resorts remain viable. Aiken County's has about, I believe, 41 licensed establishments still that are operating as resorts. We want to make sure they keep viable, because every year we're seeing more and more of ours go into development. A lot of people did, as Henry said, a lot of people put a lot of time and effort into these alternative standards. We're not opposed to the alternative standards, but we are opposed to the bill that's before us here, just because it doesn't give any incentive at all to bring structures into conformance. I know it's hard for local units of government to upgrade their ordinances without having some minimum guidelines. It depends on the board you have. I have trouble with my board getting things through. They always, if I bring something in there, they kind of, boy, what's he trying to sneak through us on here? What helps me is I lobby with my Lake Association members. I would get our resort community together. They came into our board, and our board's willing to look at upgrading our ordinance and implementing some of these alternative standards. But it took pressure from them to get our board to do it. And I know, you know, everybody wants things to happen fast. 75% of our lakeshore owners are not from Aiken County. This time of year would not be the right time for us to bring it forward. So we're waiting until June when people are back before we start doing our citizens' input committee meetings. So the process needs to have some time.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I no disrespect intended. I am completely, you're the expert. I have no idea what you're talking about. But this might be an issue that could be worked out in local government. We're just environmental people. We're just looking at those issues. And this might be something that can get worked out between here and the next stop of this bill, because you're in over my head. And
we are willing to work with the author and whoever to come up with some different language. I need to stress how important this is. This really, when you start...
Sure. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that what you're testifying to, while it's important, doesn't necessarily fall under the purview of this committee.
Mr. Neff, if you...
I guess I'd like to clarify, why is it falling into this committee? We're talking about some proposed legislation that affects zoning, and, you know, there's no provision to bring structures into conformance. And that's what our association's problem with it is.
And Representative Hoppe's point is that our jurisdiction here is environment and dealing with the environmental aspects of this bill. And we will be re-referring it, if it passes out of here, we will re-refer it to the Local Government and Metropolitan's Affairs Committee, which will deal with those issues. So, that committee, that's the area that they'll focus on. And if you'd like to testify to these issues at that committee, it would probably have a greater effect there. So,
okay.
Yeah. So, if, and I don't know if you have anything else
to say
about that. I do
have one thing I'd like to say is that Minnesota Association of County and Planning and Zoning Administrators does support the DNR's position on not bringing forth the alternative standards into rulemaking. You know, I think before or when the rulemaking starts, we need to make sure that all 87 counties have input into the process. There were only 5 counties involved in the alternative standards, and none of them have adopted the alternative standards in its entirety yet. You know, it was intended to be tools where you take pieces here and there and use it in updating your ordinance, but all 87 counties do need to have some input into this process.
Okay. Representative Wagenius.
Yes, since you talked about what you don't support, would you support having DNR begin a rulemaking process now with finding rules for all 87 counties?
Yes. Yep, we do support that.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Neff.
Thank you.
Any comments from the DNR?
Mr. Lockeslow?
Just make your comments on it. Put your name.
Emily Garlitz from the Association of Minnesota Counties. Thank you for just taking a second to just listen to the county position on this. We've spoken with Representative Moe on some of these local government issues, and we do intend on continuing to work with him. As Terry stressed, we do have many concerns about this going forward, in addition to some of the concerns that we have about the alternative standards, kind of those all tied together. We do have some questions about particularly putting them into statute as opposed to bringing them forward before all groups and all local units in government throughout the state to make these decisions via the rule process. So we will continue to work with Representative Moe, and as we go forward to see if we can find any language that we can come to agreement on.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Do you support alternative rules starting now that are mandatory? I mean, getting a rule process starting now that would be mandatory on the county?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, the county position on this is that we do support using these alternative rules and providing them out there to counties as education pieces first and foremost, and that's something that's going on right now. As we proceed into the future, if rulemaking is the way to go, we do support a statewide rulemaking process. Certainly the alternative standards should be used during that alternative process. We don't necessarily think that the alternative standards at the level that should be started at. We think that everybody needs to be brought in on discussion of all alternative standards that have been discussed prior to the rulemaking process. So, yes, we do support going forward, however, not using the alternative standards as the base to start at.
Thank you. And Representative Moe.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lacasmo has a couple more comments, and then we'll wrap up. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Kent Lacasmo, Director of DNR Waters. I'll be real brief because some of my comments actually would best probably dealt with in local government. The if you look at the brochure or the fact sheet that we handed out that was referred to in Minnesota Resorts, you see the bullets on the backside. The paragraph right below those bullets talks about, I think, the point that maybe Mr. McNamara brought up. In return, resorts must also restore or maintain a certain portion of the short impact zone. These were developed with some trade-offs, and I think we need to look at those, the environmental enhancements that can be added as we move forward. We agree with the concept that we should do something so we can keep resorts. But it should be a package that we have some of the, some of the good points and the bad points, I guess, together. And all of these are probably good, but not just picking out the good points that directly deal with the development, but also some of the points that deal with the environmental enhancements. And the other concerns we had were dealing with the preemption and taking away all local authority and some of those. But I think that's more appropriately dealt with in local government. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lacasmo. Any other questions at all? Representative Osmond.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I still, as I'm looking at that expansion section, Mr. Carlson, I do not see. I know that minimally is a term in there that supposedly gives people a mental description of what we're intending. But I'm not an attorney, and I don't see anything that specifically says that it shouldn't be any larger than required to meet the standards or codes. And, Mr. Chair, as I understood your motion earlier, it seems to me like this bill has already gone through our committee. Otherwise, I would make a motion to amend, but instead I will just talk to the author about maybe carrying this forward in local government.
Okay.
So we don't have to reconsider the previous vote.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Osmond. Any other comments or questions at all?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to thank the members' time for really working on some details of this. Again, I'll work with Representative Osmond. Representative Hansen have brought some important points forward. I expect an author's amendment and perhaps an additional amendment to consider later on. Again, just to review, this is a really important issue for our resorts. They're environmental stewards.
They want the tools in order to stay in business and to manage the resource to the best of their ability. I would appreciate the member's support for the bill.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Clarification on what Representative Osmond was asking about. We had a discussion over here, and I thought, and maybe I misunderstood, if we pass that before, if we already have taken a vote on this, I'd ask for reconsideration. Or you said we already taken a vote, I'd ask for reconsideration.
Representative McNamara moves that we reconsider House File 849. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. So, it is now before us.
Now it's before you. Now the bill's before you.
Is that a log game?
Any other comments or?
Renew the original motion.
Yeah. Before we do so, any other comments? Representative Moe?
No, I would renew my motion to move House File 849 to be referred to local government with the understanding that it will then go on to Environment Natural Resource Plan.
Representative Dill.
So is that referred, is that motion to pass?
Yes.
Yes.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Moe renews his motion that House File 849 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Local Government Metropolitan Affairs. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Bill is recommended to pass. Re-referred on the Committee of Local Government Metropolitan Affairs. And meeting is adjourned.